I'm Griffin Olenek, and I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Megan Ritchie, Commonweal's Associate Publisher. And we're here to discuss the new exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum called Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future. It's an extraordinary show, and it features something like 170 works, mostly paintings of abstract art, done by a Swedish woman that nobody in her time, as she died in about 1944, and certainly not in our time, had really ever heard of. But the Guggenheims produced this amazing show of color and shapes and light. And so Megan and I, earlier this fall, decided that we ought to go and see it. Megan, what were some of the things that drew you to Hilma af Klint? What charged you up to go and see that show?
Well, I had never even heard her name before. I felt sort of embarrassed that as a person who claims to love abstract expressionism, who's very excited by the idea of early 20th century abstract expressionism in Scandinavia, I had never even heard her name before. And then I heard all of these stories about the for whom she made the work, how she made the work, the temple that she wanted the work installed in, and all of its likeness to the Guggenheim. And I thought, this is worth seeing. We've got to get over there.
Well, it's really interesting because it's kind of right up our alley as Commonweal, right? We read about politics, religion, culture. And here you've got one of New York City's biggest cultural events and biggest cultural institutions, the Guggenheim, having a show about an unknown artist whose works are deeply spiritual. And I know for me, that was one of the biggest attractions of the show was that this was it led me to write about the show. I loved it so much. But you had, you know, this artist who had been classically trained all of a sudden discovering for herself abstraction and using it as a kind of pathway into accessing divinity. That's what I found so fascinating about it. So why don't we just say two words about what it's like to see the show? What happens when you arrive in the Guggenheim Rotunda after you've made it through security and you've got your tickets and everything else? What do you see?
You said earlier that you loved the show, and I can't help but think of what I really loved about the show, which had a little bit less to do with her reasons for making the work and her seeking, though that is very exciting to me. It had a lot to do with the forms, the tones, the color, the gesture, the grandness of the whole show, the amount of work that she made over this period of time, sort of a virtuosity in terms of abstraction, given the fact that she probably hadn't encountered that much abstract work at the time.
So yeah, it was practically non-existent in the early 1900s, right?
Right.
It's not like Kandinsky was famous or Mondrian was famous, and she said, well, I want to do that. She had to invent her own thing.
Yeah, and so that the big question that I was asking myself throughout the show was, did she invent these new forms? She certainly invented them for herself and her studio practice, but what was it that made these forms, this expression, these gestures, the rich symbolism in each of these works, what made it possible? And so we'll talk a little bit about how the curators understood that this might be possible. But I was just really excited. When you walk into the rotunda, you see the 10 largest, 10 really huge works. I guess they're probably about...
Yeah. I think there's something like
6 by 8 feet.
No, they're even bigger. They're 8 by 10.
Wow.
Or 8 by 10 and a half. Yeah, so they're larger than than an ordinary human.
Super tonal, very brightly colored, really kind of like outlandish, but also organic forms done on a big scale. And each of the pieces, though there are 10 and though they're meant to be a series, they're all completely unique. And it was just really exciting. It's not very often that you encounter work of that size and scale.
You're just kind of enveloped in it. It's like stepping into, I think my sense was, it was like stepping into almost like liquid color, like you're just awash in color. Like you start off and there are these blues and then they change to orange and then they change to pink and yellow.
And nowadays it's sort of rare to have the experience that these works elicit. It's very rare to have an experience like that apart from technology. They're that charged.
Yeah, they're really charged is a great word, I think. It's like it's really not like an iPhone screen. I mean, we're so used to these small, tiny devices with, you know, their retina displays and their brilliant colors. But these are, you know, works of tempera on paper that she allegedly had to complete by standing over them. So they were on the ground, almost like Jackson Pollock, if you think of Pollock, like, you know, throwing paint around. Off-Clint herself in the 1910s, which is when she made them, had to make individual panels that she would then paste together. But she completed them also very quickly. That was part of her process, was that she would set herself really precise limits, and that, you know, she would say, I'm going to make 7 paintings in 7 days, and that was it. And what she came up with was what that was the result. But you get the sense of freedom, creativity, and I think that's one of the things that we were mentioning. It was almost like being delivered out of our ordinary lives. We took a Friday. We don't work on Fridays in Commonweal. We do work, but not in the office. But it was like stepping outside of, you know, the chaotic city and just into this world of, I don't even know how to call it, like utter revelry in the beauty of form and color.
And so this makes sense when you think of very often the gallery as compared to the sanctuary.
Yeah.
And these works were made for a temple.
That's
so
right.
Can you talk a little bit about why you think, as a contemporary viewer encountering the works, why you sort of were transported in this way and what her intention may have been in making the works for the space?
Sure. Yeah, so let me just say a bit about Hilma af Klint and her biography. She was born in the 1880s in Sweden. She grew up in an upper middle class family. She was trained as an artist at the Royal Academy of Sweden. And she was a really talented, classically trained painter. And she sold portraits. She sold landscapes. Some of these are on view, not many of them, but early in the exhibit, just to give you a sense of how good she was at representing, seizing the natural world in its forms. But she gets increasingly interested in spirituality and religion, partly precipitated by the death of her sister when she was 18. She begins attending seances, gets interested in spiritualism and theosophy, which were popular with educated elites in Europe and America at the time. But then she just takes off on this journey where she believes that she hears a divine commission to paint a series of works for a temple, an imaginary temple that's going to be, in a way, it's Christian in inspiration, but it's also ecumenical. It's also interreligious. She was very interested in pursuing, I guess let's call it a kind of syncretism of the world's various religions. And so she understands her task in life to be, she says, I'm going to take this high commission from what she called her spiritual guides. These were the kinds of, not that she was hearing voices, but these were the, let's call them spiritual entities with whom she interacted. And that's the result we see. The Guggenheim show really, it doesn't present a full range of her works. It really just focuses on this very intense period of creativity between, I think, 1906 and 1920, during which she completed these paintings for the temple that were never seen or exhibited during her lifetime. She had this famous embargo where she said, not until, you know, nobody's ready to see them, nobody knows what they mean. I'm not sure I even know what they mean. Nobody should see them until 20 years after I died. And so that was in 1944. And it wasn't really until the 1980s that museums even began showing them. So that's really what the Guggenheim gives us, is it gives us, in a way, a quite a respectful representation of what she wanted to do. She had sketched out this temple, which was going to, you know, have multiple layers to it. It was going to be round, and it looks just like Frank Lloyd Wright's rotunda. That's what I found so striking. But it dovetails with this other discourse in the art world right now, is that in a secular culture, so many of us are longing for transcendence. And art museums, not only because of the quantity of religious art that's contained within them, but just because they're spaces that are set apart from the ordinary hustle and bustle of life, they've kind of taken on this sacred quality, I would say, at least in the 21st century.
Let's talk a little bit about the curatorial outlook of the show, some of its strengths, some of its weaknesses, and how the curator's point of view diverges from your own point of view.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm not saying...
As noted in the piece that you wrote recently for Commonweal.
And I think this was something that you and I talked about as we saw the exhibit. We felt like, on first view, that it kind of left something to be desired, that maybe it could have gone a little bit more deeply.
Not the works, but the curatorial statement. There was very... It's not even that we wanted more information. I think that we wanted a framework that was far more adequate than the framework that the curators chose.
I think that's a great way of saying it, which was, let's call it an art historical feminist reading of Auf-Clint, which is, you know, they were the show itself through wall texts, through a lot of the publications that came out with the show, was highly interested in presenting Auf-Clint as somebody who had invented abstraction before her male counterparts. And in a way, that's certainly true. You could say she arrived before Kandinsky did. You know, he wrote On the Spiritual and Art, I think, in 1910. She had already begun this project in 1906. So does it really matter that she had arrived there earlier? Can anybody really claim to own abstraction? And this is something that was happening all around Europe. The way I prefer to think about it, and again, I'm not really an art historian. I used to study poetry, and I guess I still do. But I kind of think it is if Auf-Clint was – and Auf-Clint wouldn't have made this claim for herself. She would have said, well – I'm not even really the inventor of the forms I'm depicting. I'm simply channeling what I see from my spiritual guides. So her abstraction is not...
almost recording my experience with the guide.
Exactly. Is not so much, you know, a willful assertion of her own skill with respect to Kandinsky or Piet Mondrian or any of the other people who were pursuing abstraction in Europe. It's rather to say she had a vision that she was pursuing, and the shapes that we see, the works, the colors, they're all the fruit of research that she was undertaking. I think it's, to me, it's almost a mistake to think of her uniquely as an artist, but she was really a thinker. I mean, she was a thinker who also happened to be a great painter. But the show, I think, could have done a better job of showing exactly how those two things, her art and her thought and her spiritual life, how those all kind of dovetail with each other and proceed at a pace. Instead, we get this kind of canned narrative of, well, she was the first one and she was a woman, which is true, but it doesn't seem, as you say, adequate.
Well, and also, if she was the first of her kind, if she was doing something radically inventive, if she was making works that she couldn't possibly have seen, the show, I think, in a shallow way, kind of chalks up the essence of the work into these sort of radical occult experiences,
that's
the channeling,
true. Yeah.
The instrumentation, which is true. Like, she does leave very specific notes about the five.
Those were her, the guides that she, or sorry, no, the five were the group of, you know, other Swedish women with whom she participated in seances, right?
Yeah, and so I guess what I would hope, and I'm projecting here, I'm not entirely sure, is not so much that she was being told what work to make for the temple or to reach her sister or for whatever reason,
yeah.
But rather through her religious experience, her sort of radical spiritual experience, mm-hmm. and the ways that she was seeking to practice her spirituality,
exactly.
She was enabled to imagine forms,
exactly.
and to paint in these big, large, grand, highly gestural, experimental ways,
mm-hmm.
making things that we could only imagine. So, yeah, I'm more interested in that, the mm-hmm. idea of being enabled to paint in a certain way, and less so – I'm less interested in the idea of her simply being like a conduit or a channel.
Yeah.
And the
– Yeah, she had this famous shift. I kind of talk about this in the review, where at first she's sort of experimenting, trying to be a conduit, just transcribe the forms that she sees in her prayer sessions. But then she kind of has a shift where she says, well, I can also bring in my own personal experience and reflection.
And learning.
Yeah, and learning. And so you start to see the art kind of take off, where it's no longer this super esoteric, difficult to kind of grapple with pulsations of lines and form. But instead, you have real orderly progression. So you have her kind of asserting her own, let's call it, almost co-equal status with the divine as a creator of art. As a participant, yeah. So you get this much more humble view and this much more, let's call it, you sort of see her walking humbly with God, if that makes sense. And you see that shines through in her art, yeah.
I think as a magazine of religion, not to spend too much time critiquing the curatorial positioning of the work, but I did think that even their understanding of her religious practices and spirituality seemed slightly misguided. And that's where I thought it was really unfortunate. Like, there was so much good, exciting work to be done to understand her life, to understand her desires and mm-hmm. her hopes and intentions for the work. And there was something sort of cheap about the way, in my view, the curators understood her faith.
Well, it raises kind of a larger question. I mean, this is present not only in, you know, the culture of the arts, But kind of in everything today. I mean, I was noticing that Roberta Smith, the co-chief art critic for the New York Times, in her review said, you know, quite honestly, I don't care about what Hilma af Klint believed. I'm really interested in her forms, and they're transcendent and they're beautiful, but I don't really care if she was a Christian or not. Though Hilma af Klint herself remained a committed Christian throughout her life, she had a specifically religious syncretistic project where religion was everything to her.
And the work was made for a very specific purpose.
Exactly. It was created as sacred art. So to empty it of its sacred, not to say to empty it of its sacred content, but to say that the sacred is somehow no longer important, and maybe we're going to emphasize a kind of political narrative. Because I also want to say that that narrative is completely valid. And that's a point that's made by the decision to accompany the show with a smaller show by a contemporary artist, R.H. Quaitman, who's an admirer of af Klint, who kind of presents her, reinterprets her work in a feminist vein and makes this very valid point, saying, look, Hilma af Klint, she found freedom, as many of the women mystics throughout the history of Christianity have done. She found her space, not by fulfilling, you know, the roles and expectations that society placed on her, but by doing her own thing. That is by producing art that, in a way, was not interpretable. I mean, she had her own glossary of words that she made up. So she was able to become a kind of creator, which wasn't always in the cards for women at the time. And so there is a – what I want to say is there's a real –
That's valid.
Yeah, there's a validity to the feminist presentation of her work. But it doesn't exhaust, I don't think, you know, the full range of meanings that we can find in them. Yeah, and it kind of – you know, it's not – this is kind of the point I was trying to make in my review, is that if you reduce all art to politics, well, then you can never stand outside the political.
Which is exactly what her work would have wanted.
Exactly.
Her work was meant to transport – her work was made to transport its viewers. And so by like harnessing it back in.
Exactly.
And using it sort of as an instrument in this larger cultural conversation, this political conversation, it – yeah, to me it hollows the sort of sacredness of the work out. And I was disappointed by that. Hmm. And you saw it – it's probably silly how often I mention this, but it really – crystallized for me when I went into the gift shop, eager to do the things that people do when they go to gift shops, like buy a postcard.
Well, yeah.
And there was so much great – there were some really great prints for sale. Her work – yeah.
It's beautiful.
You want to be able to buy it.
Yeah, I asked my sister to get it for me for Christmas.
You don't want the experience of seeing Witchcraft for Dummies or Ouija boards next to these prints.
There is the sense that at the same time as the show and the museum itself celebrates her feminist independence.
And this like radical dignity.
It exoticizes the kinds of spiritual beliefs that she held most sacred, right? That she said animated her work from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, you know? And I think it trivializes the work in ways that I don't even know. It just seems unfortunate to me. It seems like a mistake. So we started our conversation talking about the feeling that we experienced upon seeing the work for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And being that she was an abstract – well, definitely expressionism, abstract in a lot of the work, though some of the work was a little bit more representational.
Mm-hmm.
I want to end our conversation just talking about the feeling of abiding by her work after having left the show and just like I think of the work often.
Mm. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and so – and I think it is because of how it makes me feel, though for other reasons as well. Is there anything you'd like to add to that? Like, what sort of space did the work create for you?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think I've continued to think about it almost in the vein of joy. I think that there's a lightness to Hilma af Klint's art, and that comes through in the colors, it comes through in the curves and the lines. And I guess I believe the way that I experienced things. I went back to see it again after we had after we'd seen it that initial time, and I just saw different things. I saw almost like I was transported into the realm where she really wanted to lead me, where she wants to lead all of her viewers, and that is kind of beneath the appearance of surfaces where things can seem so jagged and out of place and chaotic. Even as we're recording this, over Riverside Park, we're listening to sirens, you know, the sounds of the city. It gave me a real respite for that through color and form. And so as I go about my day now in Advent, when we're recording this, I'm attentive to color. you know, on the sides of buildings and in trees and in the water, in the natural environments that surround things, but also in people's faces, the colors that they choose to wear. I think Hilma af Klint was, you know, attentive to all of these details. And I think what she was trying to suggest was that beneath all of it, the ways that we present ourselves, there's a unity and a beauty that takes a myriad of forms of expression. And that's what she's kind of trying to lead us into, that white space where all colors are contained, if that makes sense. So that's what, it sat with me, and, you know, I don't think it'll go away.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Griffin, thanks so much for having this conversation.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Anytime.
We should go see the work once more before the show closes.
Yes.
As should all of our listeners.
Yeah, it closes on April the 23rd of 2019.
So. And if you'd like to pick up where our conversation left off, you can return to Griffin's review published in Commonweal a few issues ago just by simply going to the website.
Great. Thank you so much, Megan.